CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And before we get started, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consultant LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News is brought to us from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, subtitled Hotel Industry Statistics. The hotels and other accommodations industry is expected to grow by 5% over the 2008 to 2018 period. The industry employs large numbers of part-time and younger workers who typically do not stay in these jobs for very long. The need to replace these workers will create job opportunities in an array of occupations and localities. In terms of employment change, wage and salary employment in hotels and other accommodations is expected to increase by 5% between the 10-year period of 2008 to 2018, compared with 11% growth projected for all industries combined. Travel and tourism typically grows during expansion periods in the economy, which results in a greater need for transient rooms. The hotel market is expected to see increases in the number of rooms, but the greatest number of rooms is expected to open in limited service hotels that do not provide food service. Many of these newer hotels are being built in the suburbs where a growing population is increasingly based and a foundation of business establishments is being developed. In terms of employment, the employment outlook varies somewhat by service of class of hotel and occupation, growth of full-service hotels, casino hotels, and the smaller luxury hotel market that specializes in personal service will cause employment of lodging managers to grow more slowly than the average. The accelerating trend among chain-affiliated hotels to establish regional management and staffing teams among several properties and across service classes should provide current assistant managers or department managers with opportunities to demonstrate their readiness for advancement, but also may limit the prospect for new manager positions. Opportunities should be more limited for self-employed managers or owners of small lodging places, such as bed and breakfast inns, because of the competition from long-established chains as they move into the untapped markets that were once friendly to the quainter properties. Job opportunities at outdoor recreation and RV parks should grow as RVs and driving vacations begin to gain popularity in the United States. And also, gaming services and gaming manager occupations should grow as more casino hotels are built. Employment of hotel, motel, and resort desk clerks is expected to grow faster than some other occupations in the industry, in part because the growing numbers of limited service hotels that still require desk clerks. However, employment of dishwashers will decline within the industry, reflecting the increasing number of hotels and other accommodations that either do not offer full-service restaurants or contract them out to other food establishments. Well, we're talking in the news section today of CFO Radio about the hotel industry because today our guest joining us is Bob Gunkel. He is the Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, the Americas Division of IHG, otherwise known as Intercontinental Hotels Group, PLC. Bob leads the Americas finance function and is responsible for the management of financial operations for all properties in North and South America. Bob joined IHG in 1995 from Marriott. Since then, he's held a number of senior positions in finance, including the role of Vice President, Financial Planning and Analysis for the Americas. Most recently, Bob served as Vice President, Global Finance Transformation. In this role, he led the work to improve efficiencies within the organization for finance by making most of the regional capabilities and global scale. Bob earned an MBA in finance from the Wharton School of Business, and he earned an undergraduate degree in accounting from the University of Virginia. Well, wow. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Bob, let's start at the beginning. What was your first job and how did that bring you to arrive at your current position?
Well, my first job was I actually went to work on Wall Street for a company called Drexel Burnham Lambert, which anyone who is a student of financial history remembers that as the old junk bond Michael Milken days. So it was a great, indoctrination into the world of high finance. Unfortunately, it did not end well as, Rudy Giuliani, who was the U.S. District Attorney at the time, indicted the company and basically the firm imploded. So I had to pack up my bags along with everybody else and we all got kind of ushered out the door.
So that was your first job. How old had you been? You'd been let go and severed. How old were you at that time?
I would have been about 23.
My goodness, that's pretty early.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting as we as I interview more and more CFOs. You're a little bit younger than some of our average CFOs, and power to you. I think that's absolutely great. And what we find is that the younger CFOs have actually had severance and layoffs earlier in their career. And what we tend to find is that the people in their 50s and their 60s, that's really a recent phenomenon for them.
Yeah, I think it definitely teaches you that, business is fickle and unpredictable. And, it also gives me some sympathy for people that work in organizations that are under stress that, you know, you can't, just to give a perspective, I went to business school after that and then went tried to work back on Wall Street. And, of course, I interviewed with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and all those
guys.
Aren't
you glad you didn't go with those guys, right?
Well, yeah, but I guess at the time, you know, effectively, I felt like I was kind of, quote-unquote, blacklisted because when you work for a company that's, been indicted, you know, obviously as a 21, 23-year-old, I wasn't, you know, necessarily involved in any wrongdoing, nor did I even know about any wrongdoing. But unfortunately, they kind of tarred the whole organization with the same brush. So that kind of caused me to say, you know what, I think I'll hit the pause button on financial services, which is one of the reasons I said, you know what, I think I'd really like to go into industry in a financial capacity, which is why I went to Marriott.
So you went straight into Marriott, and did you come up through the analysis side or the accounting side?
Actually, the analysis side. My background is primarily in analytics around new hotel projects and mergers and acquisitions. I'm actually not a CPA, but as I tell a lot of people, that actually was great preparation for the kind of decision-making that I have to do today, because the real key decisions that I spend my time thinking about are, you know, should we put a $50 million hotel here or there, and is this the right investment? The debits and credits side, I don't really spend a lot of time on day to day. It's really the big decisions about where we allocate capital.
So a big part of your chief financial officer role is forward strategic thinking.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting, as I interview CFOs on the radio show, there's two paths. Obviously, the CPA, the accounting. What everybody knows is if you say that you work in accounting and finance, everyone thinks bean counters, right? And
that's right.
We're all tarred with that one brush. But the finance path is so strong. It's so key for a company. And if you don't have the opportunity to look forward in the right manner, 1% off can take away your margins.
Absolutely. And you have to take a view of about a lot of things. You have to take a view about where the economy is headed, where you have to, it's art and science, and there's a lot of judgment involved. And particularly hotels are, one of the things that happens in the hotel industry is everybody forecasts that they want to add X hotels into a market, but unfortunately they don't contemplate all the time that everybody else is thinking the exact same thing. So sometimes you have to step back and say, you know, if everybody does what we're doing, is this market going to be oversupplied? And that's actually what's happened in a lot of, lodging is very much a boom and bust kind of business where too many people pile into a market at one particular time because it was the hot market, and then it kind of leads to mutually assured destruction.
Almost like the gold rush.
Exactly. And nowadays, I think lenders are a lot more, well, first of all, a lot more parsimonious about lending money to the sector, but also I think they look at the market more holistically and say, you know, there's not that much room for that many properties here, so we're going to be very selective about how we lend, which actually is a good stabilizer for the industry.
And your company, Intercontinental Hotels Group PLC, it's UK owned.
Correct.
And so I, having traveled various parts of the world, I'm familiar with some of those hotel chains. You have responsibility for the Americas division.
Correct.
And is that North and South America?
That's right.
So you've got a lot of international foreign currency elements to manage in terms of the Caribbean and some of that Southern American.
Absolutely. And where it really gets complicated is trying to bring money out of some of the Latin American countries like Venezuela. I mean, that I absolutely pull my hair out trying to think about, you know, we earn money and we have a large intercontinental in Caracas, which is quite famous, called the Tamanaco. Actually, interesting side story, the Intercontinental brand was founded as the outbound hotel company for Pan Am. So this show that's on right now called Pan Am, we've been talking to them about, we need to get Intercontinental in there because people needed a place to stay when they flew on Pan Am Airlines to somewhere like Caracas, Venezuela. So we were a real pioneer in Latin America. We have hotels in most of the countries down there. But it is challenging because of the regulatory and tax regimes to try to bring money back into the United States. So so that gives you pause when you think about, do I want to put more money in more hotels there, and do I want to put more capital investment into Latin America? Because, again, in certain countries, it is hard to pull the money out.
Now, I've got to ask the question, being that I'm a travel, I won't call myself a travel freak, but I'm a travel lover. Is that important to you? You've talked about the airlines, you've talked about, obviously, the hotel industry. Is that something that's your passion?
Absolutely. I love to travel. I mean, pretty much if I have any free time, I try to go to a hotel that I haven't visited in our system. And I just get this thrill when I walk into a new hotel that I haven't visited in our system. And I'm just a big believer that you've got to really love the business you're in. And particularly when you're in hospitality, and one of the things I look for when I interview people is, do you love service? Do you love hospitality? In fact, I've started even asking, tell me about your last travel experience.
Why and that's true of the accounting finance function?
Absolutely. Because you've got to, you know, I'm sure there's some people in my department that, you know, they are crunching numbers and they could be doing it for any type of company. But I think, you know, the passion really comes out when they realize they're there to serve a hotel and they're there to help a hotel serve a guest. And so one of the things, like I said, I've started indexing on when I interview people is, tell me why you love to serve people and tell me why you love the service.
So I've got to ask, what have been the weird responses that you've had there? Anything that you've decided, oh my goodness, no, this is not a fit?
No, I mean, I think that you get some people that are just kind of homebodies that really, they kind of say, you know, when you say like, what's your favorite place? And they're like, well, you're kind of standing on it. So, you know, they, that really don't have that spirit of adventure. I wouldn't say that would preclude me from hiring somebody, but, what I really get energized about is that, you know, and I interviewed someone recently, it was like, oh yeah, I went to New Zealand and it was just fascinating. And I saw all the places where they filmed Lord of the Rings. And when you see that, just the light come up in their eyes when they've experienced a new place or been in a new hotel, that's when I look at them and say, like, that person's going to be a great fit with that organization.
I guess the perfect scenario would be a husband and wife team. Maybe one of them works for the airline and the other one works for the hotel. And you can just, you know, that's your vacation plan set, right?
Oh, believe me, we have a few of those people that, because since Delta is based here, and everybody looks at them with total jealousy because they basically are footloose and fancy free.
So you know what they do, 5 o'clock when they clock off on a Friday, right?
Oh, exactly.
Well, let's start tracing a couple of your steps back. You started obviously in financial services, and you came through a little bit of at the time, thinking that it was a disappointing move that you weren't going to be able to go back to the Goldman Sachs and so forth. But you started with Marriott. Tell us a little bit about the transition from Marriott to IHG. From the outside looking in, two different hotel chains. Was there a learning experience for you in terms of a different style of culture? And I don't necessarily want to ask you anything confidential about the culture of each, but just in terms of transition. Today we find that transition is very significant for employees, no matter what age you are. There's no such thing as loyalty with a 40-year job anymore. So was that transition tough for you?
Marriott and IHG, or I guess at the time I left, it was Holiday Inn Worldwide. We've gone through a number of name changes, and at the time the parent company was Bass PLC, which made Bass Ale.
You got to love that when a hotel chain's owned by a brewery.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I did work over in the UK for a couple of years, and we used to get a product allowance, which was always wonderful. This big Bass truck would turn up on Fridays, and you had a little point system, and you know, they would basically drop off a bunch of beer at your desk, which is always a lot of fun. But anyway, Marriott and IHG. Holiday Inn. Holiday Inn was is an iconic brand, and I'd always had an interest in it. The difference between the two companies: one is primarily managed, and our company is primarily franchised. So we have a lot of independent owners. If anyone's familiar, people that are familiar with the Holiday Inn brand, the way it was started was a gentleman by the name of Kemmons Wilson left Memphis on a road trip with his family to drive to Florida, and he was frankly dismayed at the Bates Motel psycho kind of hotels, you know, that you used to see on the side of the road, and said, you know, there have got to be hotels on the road that I would feel comfortable staying with my family. And so, you know, we've always been the brand of the Great American Road Trip, and just the history of kind of the you know, the middle class family traveling and just getting in their car and going somewhere. And that's, you know, and enabling travel for, you know, the general population. And I think, again, that just goes back to what energizes me, because Holiday Inn really did democratize travel to pretty far-flung places. And we're also one of the first brands globally going over to China before everybody else. So Holiday Inn's just always been a pioneer. And that, again, just really has a strong appeal for me.
Fabulous. So now you're at IHG. You've successfully managed the finance functions for quite substantial businesses in the hotel industry. Let's talk a little bit about maybe hotel branding, if that's the correct term, for the industry in general. I'm not asking you to say anything specific about your company, but what sort of things are new?
The hotel business has always been, or particularly, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, I kind of call it, and some people call it, the sea of sameness. There's just a lot of homogeneity. If you go into a typical guest room and you wake up the next morning, particularly if you're a road warrior, that first 5 minutes, you probably have no idea where you are, what hotel chain you're in, or anything like that. It's very, there's just a very kind of homogeneous environment. So, and I think that's given rise to things like Priceline and Hotwire, because it ultimately degrades. Well, you know, if you think about those business models, you basically put in a price and say, I want to stay in New York City, and they basically tell you where you're going to stay. And the industry needs to move away from that. And I think one of the reasons that's happened is because lenders and owners want hotels to be as generic as possible, because then they can freely trade brands if they need to. All of us in the industry, I think, are trying to do is differentiate our product somewhat. And one of the brands that we really are really stepping forward with that is a brand called Hotel Indigo, which is a branded boutique.
Hotel Indigo.
Indigo, that's right. And so what that does is that kind of lumps the security of a brand with the coolness of a boutique. So the way I like to look at it is, it's a boutique that you won't feel like you're not cool enough to go into. Like, you know, there's sometimes I walk into a boutique hotel and everyone's wearing black, and I'm like, the only thing out of place in here is me, frankly. and so what we try to do, and so that's got things. Some of the neat hallmarks we put in there is like hardwood floors in the rooms, the pebbly tile showers with stand-ups, no tub. So, you know, just some really cool design elements so that you feel like there's an experience there. Because if I go back to when I was young and when I used to stay in hotels, it was always a real event to stay in a hotel, because there was something really cool that you didn't have at your house, like a great TV with a ton of channels, or an indoor-outdoor pool or something. You were just like, wow, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So we're trying to get back to that era where a hotel stay is a really memorable experience, as opposed to what I was saying in the beginning, a sea of sameness.
Yeah, sea of sameness. Hate that. In fact, hate that in any industry. Marketing is all about differentiation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine that the hotel industry spends a lot of time and investment of money on its capital infrastructure, albeit that don't really want to get into the debits and the credits and the accounting policy details. I would imagine much of the spending is expense rather than capital. But tell us a little bit about the hotel industry model as it relates to these sorts of expenditures.
Capital expenditure is something that we spend a lot of time on and think about a lot, because you really have two elements to it. You have the the front of house spend, the guest facing spend, and then the back of house spend. And you don't want to neglect one or the other. And so particularly as hotels get older, you have issues with the boilers and the chillers and the, you know, the plumbing and the infrastructure.
And these are things that the customer doesn't even see.
Absolutely. And they take it as a given. And they take it as a given that the, you know, air conditioning is going to work and all that sort of stuff. And as a hotel gets older, that becomes an ever-increasing share of what you've got to spend on the hotel. Then on top of that, you've got the stuff that you need to be constantly doing in the front of the house to refresh the product, the chairs, you know, the bedding. And then every so often an initiative will come along, like I would say 6 or 8 years ago, there was things around bedding and heavenly beds and all those sorts of things. And so you've got to be prepared to fund all of that stuff. And then you have just the normal stuff that happens in the course of a hotel. Things just break. And I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about the hotel business is a hotel opens on its very first day, and then after that, it never closes. It's perpetually open. I mean, for the rest of its life, it will never, ever close again. So you've got to be prepared for all of the unique situations that will come up just in the daily operation of a hotel. So capital expenditure is a big part of life in the hotel business, and constantly monitoring what you're spending on a hotel is a big chunk of my job.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit away from the hotel industry today. When we were talking about preparing for the show, there's a topic that's very close to your heart, and that is of personal finance. We're going to get into that subject. But before we do talk about, let's talk one last component in terms of the industries. How do hotel companies finance? And what is the funding market today in the economy? I mean, we're arguably, depending on which CFO report that you read, you know, half of the CFOs on the left of the room say we're in a double dip and we're going down into a second recession. The other half of the room say, well, hey, we haven't really left the first one. So where are you finding issues, or are you finding that the financing is getting a little lighter for us?
Yeah, and that's financing is very difficult for the lodging industry right now, which is actually unfortunate because the fundamentals of the lodging industry, from my perspective, are as good as they've ever been. I think that you've got emerging travel from a lot of countries as an emerging middle class comes along, and then within the United States, there's been not much new supply added to the lodging business in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, while demand has just continued to ratchet up. And coupled with that is I have a view that people view travel as a birthright to some extent. One of the things we saw in 2008 was people really put the brakes on travel, whether it was for business or personal. And there was about 18 months where people just did not travel at all. I think where we are now,
it was a perfect storm of still some security-related issues after some of the international scares that we've had, and then the recession. And what I would say is there's been, particularly in the U.S., a big push for businesses to communicate by video conferencing, telephone conferencing, and all those components, plus maybe one or two other factors. They must have impacted your industry.
Much less than I would have expected. I think most people realize that face-to-face interaction between you and your customer and your client, there's really no substitute for that. And so I think that eventually people just said, you know what, life's too short. I've got to get out and see my customers. I've got to take my kids to Disney before they grow up. I've got to get out and see the world. And frankly, you know, I just really prioritize travel, and getting out and seeing the world is very high and on the list of things that I want to be doing. So what we're seeing in the industry is just, you know, I wouldn't say it's, you know, absolute gangbusters, but it's clicking along at a very nice pace. And so what's going back to what's unfortunate about the lending environment is I think lenders are really more concerned about the macroeconomic environment and the volatility there, because the reality of a hotel is you've got to sell it every single night. So today you may be 90% occupied, tomorrow you could be zero. It's a lot like the airlines in that respect. Once a night is over, it's over. It's just like a plane taking off. Once the plane is taken off, it's gone. So, you know, I think that lenders look at that and say, you know, this is not like signing a rent roll where you basically can have a guaranteed income stream for 10 years on your office building. you have to work to fill that hotel up every single night. So I think the macroeconomic environment worries the lenders more than anything else, which is, again, is unfortunate because I do feel good about where our industry is.
And an international company such as yours, if you have the capacity to borrow in one country, it could offset the limitations that perhaps are provided in another country area.
We borrow corporately, but most hotel projects tend to be funded at the local level. In fact, particularly with our franchisees, the way the deals are getting done it's a relationship deal between a person in his local market that may be a well-known developer with his local banker. And that's actually about one of the few places where deals are getting done. Where deals aren't getting so much done is the big institutional lenders that feel like they have been burned for one way or another, or have a negative perception about lending into the lodging industry.
Sure, understand. Well, let's take that element of conversation from business finance down to the topic of personal finance, which is a very strong passion of yours. First, tell us, why is this a subject that you're so passionate about?
I'm passionate about it because I think I've learned a lot about personal finance just on the fly, and because it's my area of expertise. And one of the things I sometimes sit back and ponder is, do people really understand how their mortgage works, or how compounding of interest works, or how to balance their checkbook? And, obviously because it's my discipline, I've picked it up along the way, but my experience, at least in my schooling, is there's very little formalized education around personal finance.
And so perhaps it would come or not come from your parent and your community structure.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I firmly believe is an employee or that is secure in their financial situation in their personal life is going to be a much better employee at work in terms of likelihood to commit fraud or do anything else, because, unfortunately, desperate people do desperate things. And so, one of the best ways, I think, to prevent fraud is to make sure that your employee population is stable and secure.
Understand. And obviously, in being in the hotel industry, you want to make sure that your customer is also safe and secure, not only safe from a perspective of personal safety, but you want to make sure that you're safe from the perspective of you must take a significant amount of your customers paying by credit card. I would imagine the majority, if not close to about 100%. And so fraud and those kind of issues with credit cards, do you see that prevalent in the industry?
The industry is one that it probably more so than others, to your point, that can be at more risk for fraud. We've taken extensive steps to meet what's called a PCI compliance, that basically the card issuers have all sorts of rules and regulations in terms of how to treat cards, all of your internal security and processes, who handles cards. And we work very, very hard at that because, we do handle customers' cards in the restaurants and in the hotel constantly. So that's something we're very, very attuned to and I spend a lot of time on.
So at the personal level, what are we not teaching ourselves? And why do you think that the U.S. has so much debt per capita?
What are we not teaching ourselves? I think that, when people sign up for mortgages and all that sort of stuff, mortgage amortization is a complicated topic. It's even somewhat complicated for a finance person to understand. Compounding of interest, balancing checkbooks. It's just basically saying, can I afford all the obligations that I'm signing up to here? And, car leases and all that sort of stuff. And the people on the other side are incredibly sophisticated. And they have people like me that run all these numbers and know all the, ins and outs of how these things work. And so, it's a bit of a one-sided process. So I think, and going back to, our country having a lot of debt, I think a lot of that is due to our tax regime very much favors, because of the tax deductibility of interest on home equity loans and mortgages, I think it favors taking on debt because, at least when the markets were more stable and you could deduct your mortgage and your home equity loan, there was a pretty strong incentive to effectively lever your house up as highly as you could, particularly if you knew your house was appreciating. So I think what we're going through today is a deleveraging process because people are saying, you know what, I can't really pull money out of my house or not pay down my debt and expect to earn a higher return somewhere else. So what I think is happening, which is very healthy, which is basically saying, you know what, I'm going to any incremental dollar that I'm going to get, I'm going to pay down mortgage or pay down credit card because there's really not a better use for the money. And I think back in the go-go times, a lot of people said, you know, there is maybe a better use for the money. I can put it in the market or I can do this or that. And I think people are just fundamentally rethinking that. And so I think that's causing people to effectively delever their own balance sheets downward.
And also, I think the complexities of maybe you take out a car loan, that there are still some car loans that are on a simple interest basis today. Not many, but there are some. There are other aspects of financing that perhaps you might take out that are quoted on different compounding levels, maybe daily compounding, monthly compounding, annual compounding. And I don't know necessarily that the average consumer even is aware of the fact that various credit cards can be compounded in different ways, depending on the day of payment of the billing cycle versus the actual end of the statement period. You know, those periods are now getting shorter and the expectation is 3 weeks, not 4 weeks. And so your payment time and all of this compounding of interest and the charges that are charged, they are just becoming almost too complicated for the average non-financial person to even comprehend.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I think just what you were just saying, I mean, you're presuming actually a lot more knowledge than I think most people have about even how what compounding is and how compounding works, and that charging interest on interest, that can be your best friend if you're a saver, but it can be your worst nightmare and your worst enemy if you're a borrower. And, you know, just taking someone through how that works, how you've got to pay, you know, 16% on 16% on 16%, and how that can basically escalate and skyrocket. If you actually put those numbers in front of people and they actually see it, how it works over time, people can be really shocked in either direction. And again, it can work to your benefit if you're a saver. And so, and again, that's just to the fact that our society really has a dearth of places to go find out that information and be taught that. And, you know, we need to improve that somehow.
So whose responsibility is it to, quote unquote, teach about personal financing and the responsibilities of taking out loans? Is it in the household? Should we learn that? Is it in school? Should the school system, one would hope that, you know, students would come out of a school with an education to live, not necessarily just to pass exams. And there are perhaps people that have one perspective on that or the other. Or is it the company with whom you're taking the debt? Should they be teaching you?
I think it's all of those things. I think that it takes a village, and I think that, you know, unfortunately, some people won't probably be blessed to have the knowledge disseminated through their families. So I think, you know, they're certainly having classes in school. One of the things I'd like to do is, you know, within my finance group is I'd like to find a way to pioneer that in the local community, again, because we draw off the local community to find workers and find employees. So, again, I'd want those employees to be financially stable. So I would imagine the last place you're probably going to get the information is from, I mean, anytime I ever get a credit card solicitation or anything, or they make a change to my account, it's usually in 5 pages of type that I can't even read without my glasses. So, you know, I think that constituency probably obfuscates the truth more than anybody. So I think, you know, I think any of those sources can potentially help with that.
So I'm thinking back to the first time that I took out a mortgage, and it was frightening the amount of paperwork that was put my way to sign. Trying actually being a financial person, I wanted to key in on the numbers, and the pages where they were, it was almost hidden as to the amount of interest. Understandably, there was an interest rate assigned. Clearly, there was, but the amount of complexities within that compounding. It was very difficult to know. Being that I'm from abroad, mortgages are very different. Mortgage interest allowance is, in some countries, not even allowed. There's no tax benefits, and certainly where I came from, there is no tax benefit to the mortgage interest. But even on a basic level, trying to understand what exactly you're taking on, I have a general rule of thumb that for every, you know, $10,000 of mortgage that you're taking on, you're probably going to pay 4 or maybe 5x times that, although that may be a little bit reduced in today's interest rate times. Mm-hmm. But when people talk about a 4%, a 5%, a 5.8% mortgage, and you then say to them, well, you're actually paying four times the amount of capital that you're borrowing back as a repayment, that is somewhat way out of their comprehension.
Yeah, and then I think, and then people also struggle with the concept of time value of money, that that a dollar today is worth less, is worth more than a dollar 4 or 5 years from now. And then, you know, on the face of it, again, that is pretty scary that you pay 4 and 5 times, but then the notion is that you're having access to that money for many, many years, and that because of inflation, if you pay a dollar against that mortgage 25 years from now, it's going to be worth it, its purchasing power is a lot less. So there are, you know, again, debt is not inherently in itself a bad thing. It's just understanding it and controlling it. And certainly going back to your mortgage documents, there are certainly ways to express how a mortgage works that are much easier and more transparent than the legal documentation that you get today. Like, you know, for example, a graph. You could do a graph on, you know, the way a mortgage works is the payment is exactly the same every month, but what changes is the proportion that you apply to principal and the proportion that you apply to interest, and it changes over time. So a little chart basically showing, you know, that graph of the proportion of principal to interest as it changes over time. I mean, even something like that is just immensely helpful. But, you know, the notion that they would put a graph or a chart in a set of mortgage documents is probably pretty unlikely. So one of the first things I do, I know when I'm doing something like that, is I go onto Microsoft Excel and I build one myself, and I just kind of stare at it and say, okay, let me look at this. All right, makes sense to me. And, you know, but again, that's not the standard practice. Mm.
So what would you advise, let's say, to a student that is looking at perhaps their first element of debt? It may be actually student loans for the for the studying, or it may be taking out a credit card. Is there anything that you might advise them as they start the journey of the worldwide credit function?
Yeah, I guess the advice obviously is that you know, particularly in the last couple of years, as we've seen the ups and downs, you have to make sure that you, I do this in the hotel business, that your cash flow can stand up to a variety of scenarios, both positive and negative. So one of the things I do when I look at a hotel is I have people run various sensitivities around, suppose things go really well or suppose things go really poorly. And one of the things I think, you know, people have to look at is, if things go poorly for me, I have whatever, unexpected medical bills, or I have to support a member of my family, even in that quote-unquote downside scenario, have I got sufficient resources to cover all the obligations that I have? And so, because I think what everybody does is they mentally project probably the most rosy scenario in their life, that, you know, I'm never going to get injured, or I'm never, you know, going to lose my job, or any of that sort of stuff. And they think, well, okay, if all this happens according to plan, then I can service all these obligations. But one of the things I've learned from the hotel industry is nothing ever goes according to plan. Something particularly in the hotel industry, we're one of the most volatile industries you have, because you have 9/11, you have the oil spill, and we're subject to random shocks. We have the volcano in Europe, which basically, you know, shut down travel in Europe for a while. So one of the things I'm acutely attuned to is the world never comes out the way you expect. And so,
what is it that John Lennon said? Life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans.
Exactly. So my advice to anybody who's, I guess, taking on obligations like this, whether you're young or whatever age, is think about all the various scenarios that might happen in your life, and say, you know, would I is any of this going to make me uncomfortable if things don't exactly turn out the way I plan?
And so for that first time student, maybe the major component may be not getting that first job. I mean, 5 and 10 and 20 years ago, with a degree coming out of college or coming out of high school, you would have expected to have a job. But there's a lot of those that are unemployed today.
Well, going back to how we started the conversation, when I was 23 years old, CNN filmed me carrying out a box of my personal possessions out from a building on Wall Street. And so I'm looking at myself going, okay, I'm 23 years old. I just got laid off, fired from my first job, along with everybody else. What do I do now? And so that was, you know, on that Monday, I was coming in thinking, wow, I have a really long, busy week ahead. And by Friday, I was basically carrying my stuff out in a box. So you just never know.
Yeah, you never know. Well, we have a tradition on the radio show, Bob, to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? What is yours?
I'm a big fan of what I call skip-level meetings, and what I do is, over the course of a year, I try to meet with probably every person in my organization. And I have a one-hour meeting with them in my office, and I basically say, I talk to them about what can I do to help you achieve your goals, your career goals. So, and what that helps me to do, and I spend a lot of time talking to them about what kind of work they like, what kind of work they don't like, and trying to form really a mental picture of, it helps me in terms of resource planning. And then I ask them, I said, you know, if I was going to, you know, nominate you for a project or something, what sorts of projects do you like and which ones do you don't like? So that helps me have, again, a mental picture in my head of my department, where the strengths and weaknesses are, what people are good at. Because when you take the time to learn the composition of your team and your department, then you play to their strengths and minimize their weaknesses, that's the key to a high-performing team. So I'm a big believer in skip levels. And, you know, one of the things that my ground rule is, you know, you're not here to dish on your boss or complain about anything, you know, in terms of your work environment. This is really more about how can I help you get to where you would like to go. And so I try to keep that up. I guess in my department I have about 60 people, so that's a pretty big time commitment. But I try to phase it all through the year. And so I try to make sure that I've had a pretty significant personal interaction with everybody on my team at least once a year.
Fabulous. Well, that's a great tip. Thank you very much, Bob. From a formal perspective, I'd like to thank Bob Gunkel for being our guest today. Bob, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lorraine.
And thanks also to our contributor for the news, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And a plethora of statistics can be found at www.bls.gov. Thanks go to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks also to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And the National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. Their website can be found at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at www.cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or you would like to be a guest on the radio show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.